This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, community radio from Simon Fraser University.
Burnaby is located on the ancestral and stolen homelands of the Halkumalam and Squamish-speaking peoples. I'm Stella, the programming assistant at the station.
And I'm Logan. I'm in the community outreach and promotions position at the station.
And together, we will be doing Pride programming for the summer.
So stay tuned for interviews, music, and special segments centering around queerness, veering away from our heteronormative understandings.
Welcome to the first part of a two-part interview. The second part will air at the same time next Thursday. Today, I will be airing a conversation I had with Paulette Putra, an influential voice from the Two-Spirit Indigenous community, bringing a critical perspective on colonial legislation and Indigenous resurgence to the airwaves. Hello, everyone. My name is Stella, and today I'm here with Paulette Putra, the Executive Director at Two Spirits in Motion Society, the first national 2S LGBTQIA+ organization. Thank you so much for joining me today, Polly. Could you please...
Thank you.
Can you please tell our listeners a bit about yourself?
I'll give you my update, how I usually start every interview. Is usually I just start with my own language. So Hamutakiapi, Mija Takota Sheheaho Imakawi Makiapi, Makbieska Makiapi, Mija Wente Chante Washte. I'm a Dakota Cree. I'm from Treaty 4. And that's located in Saskatchewan. My home reserve is from Musketeering First Nation. I'm two-spirited, identified. I use she, they pronouns. My GST name is Paulette Putra. My preferred name is Polly. I'm married. I've been married for 5 years. I've been with my partner for 6. We have 3 children, 2 grandchildren, a dog, a cat, everything in between. I'm like really, really, really extremely happy where I am in life. I'm executive director for Two Spirits in Motion Society, going to be 2 years, September 6th. So it's been quite the journey, but it's been a beautiful journey at that. And I love to bead in, so if that's just a random fact that you wanted to know.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for that introduction. It's so great to have you on CJSF. Before we get started with the other questions that I'm going to ask, can you describe the term two-spirit the best that you can, given the very binary nature of the English language?
The word itself was coined from one of our community members, and it was done in late 80s, early 90s, but it was like, the way people explain it or understand it is unique to each person. Mm-hmm. Unique to each individual that identifies two-spirit, but essentially it's an Indigenous person that comes from the 2S LGBTQIA+ community and how they identify. There's different terminologies like Indigiqueer, or some people use all these different acronyms that will best identify and that they can relate to, but being two-spirit essentially is an Indigenous person that comes from the community. And there's different understandings of what came from this visionary of two-spiritness. But for myself, I identify as Wigde. If I'm going to explain to anybody what that means, I at least have the origin and the background story and understanding of that, because it comes from our language base in Dakota. So I have teachings in that, but within every linguistic group, they have specific terms that identify with the non-binary queer folks within the community, within each languages. And for myself, I identify better with Wigde, and I have like origin stories of it. I have teachings around it. And to me, it's a society. It's a society of people within our society, mm-hmm. that they work within the community. And majority of that work is done now in colonial contexts, where people need to try to understand what this term is, two-spirit. We always get feedback, sometimes it's negative from people within our own community saying, well, not one person can have two spirits. And it's not even that concept of like having physically or metaphysically two spirits, but mm-hmm. it wasn't just a binary world. We had that understanding that different beings, different genders, different roles and responsibilities were there pre-contact. And those knowledges are slowly starting to wake up. And fast forward 20, 40 years now, and it's been flourishing within communities. And this term has been coined pan-Indigenous, but really it's, and like we have younger queer, younger Indigenous folks that come from the community that don't identify with as two-spirit, but they might identify as digi-queer because they don't feel like they're spiritually connected or stuff like that. So there's that disconnect also mm-hmm. that has happened, and that has happened through Indian residential schools, 60 Scoop, any kind of systematic forms of communities like the justice system, education system, health system
mm-hmm.
that has disconnected us from ourselves. That we, a lot of our community live now in the urban centers, not living on reserve. And then being able to not really connect with that term. So we have different terminologies, but essentially it's a queer person or an Indigenous person that comes from the community of 2SLGBTQQIA+. I hope I answered your
question. Yeah, no, that was a very thorough answer. I really appreciate it. That was good. Thank you. And it kind of leads me into my next question. Can you describe Two Spirits in Motion Society and its mission within the community and also more at large?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we're a national organization that is made up of a body of Indigenous identified queer folks. And our vision and mission is to essentially have safety and well-being for our 2SLGBTQQIA+ members and have us a place when we talk about any aspect of life, whether it's education, justice, health, any form of anything, that we're there and we're representing our community as best as we possibly can. We're a young national organization, mm-hmm. meaning we're working among like the big four, which would be like NWAC, national, like the Women's Association, Native Association, and then Métis Nation, and then AFN, versus Assembly Nation. And those have been around for about 40 plus years. We're the younger organization, and we're just trying to create safe spaces for our community members when in every aspect of life, and be able to provide programming to not only ourselves at 2SLGBTQQIA+, like not only us here at 2SIMS, but also our kin organizations. And we have 13 kin organizations. Some people would call that in a binary place, oh, my sister organization, but we call it our kin organization because mm-hmm. we don't believe in the binary. Those are our kin relatives. And so those relatives and those other organizations specifically stay in specific regions and help out their community members there, and they're more grassroots level. As a national organization, we're able to get funding that they're not able to get at times, and then we share that funding with them, and they can provide that grassroots level of community support. So our goal and ultimate goal really is just so that our community members, wherever they are, that they can rely on us to like have that programming or be there as support, or look at those spots where we need to be doing work. And a lot of it is national level, sometimes it's international level, sometimes it's regional, provincial, whatever it is. And it's being able to work collaboratively with our organizations.
Really important work that you guys are doing. Just earlier you mentioned that it's been kind of a journey as an executive director. What have you learned during that?
Oh my goodness. that the ship is always on fire. Just kidding.
I mean,
no,
that's
but
fair.
I say that as a joke with like other nonprofit organizations mm-hmm. where we always feel like we're constantly putting out fires with wherever we're working. But really, it's been quite the journey. When I started, I was the third executive director in 4 months. And so there was a high turnover when I started. We have an interim executive director, that's Jonathan Potskins, and we had an acting executive director, that's Albert McLeod. And then we had an acting board, if you want to consider that as another executive director, that would have been three, and then myself would have been four, if we're being technical. But when I came on board, there was a lot of different, because how do you carry out somebody else's vision if you don't really have that one-on-one conversation? Nobody passes you the torch. You're just picking up where everybody is left off, and you're just hoping for the best, really. Because what you might read might be interpreted differently within your own brain. And so it's been quite the journey of being able to understand how to navigate within these spaces. And also, out of all of the executive directors that we had, because we had Richard Jenkins, then we had Jonathan Potskins, and we have Albert McLeod, then myself, I'm the first female identified. And so that comes with its own narratives and its own packages, whatever that looks like. And some of it looked like lateral violence. And I had to like really level out the playing field and like really try to approach all of these things in a fair and concise way, in a professional manner. And the way I combated a lot of that was through ceremony. So for myself, I grew up in ceremony. I'm going to be 40 this year. That's like a big woo-woo for me, but I grew up with it. That's 40 years of experience bringing that to the table and being able to say, let's slow it down and let's just like get back to prayer. And then being able to like move and operate within these spaces in a good way and trying to bring in those holistic indigenous protocols, traditions within the work that we're doing. And it seems to be working in a good way. So we have like really, we have an amazing team. I can never say enough about my team. I can't do this job without them. Honestly, I have amazing, amazing staff. They're just really well-rounded. When I started, we had a really small staff. We had like six of us. And it doesn't sound like a lot. And then when you bring on other people, we've expanded now to 12. There's 12 of us working. And wow. Like that's a lot of people within a 2-year span and still being able to cover so much ground. And they've really done amazing work within this. And I cannot take any credit for it. All I can do is like support my staff. All I can do is show up for them in a good way. We started doing some really great work with one another. And I think what really has supported my staff is just meeting them where they're at and working on what skills they need to develop. And I say this story, I use this as an example all the time, but I had a staff that used to put their sleeve in front of their mouth and talk to me with their sleeve in front of their mouth because they were so shy. And like they wouldn't have their screen on and were all remote. And it worked on like that self-esteem and being able to work with them and teach them leadership roles. And now they're going to places like the UN as a youth ambassador. And that's huge. That's a huge, a lot of people like think of that as like, oh, that's like some people might see it, some people might not. But for me, that was like huge, where I have staff that are very comfortable and very confident in the spaces that they go to. And I trust them. I trust them enough to show up for Two Spirits in Motion Society in a professional and on a national level. And I remind my staff, what you do on your days off, like be very mindful of your surroundings. You're representing us at all times. Because whether you show me what you're doing or you don't, people will always come back to me and let me know what's going on. So I always remind people that we're representing a large nation of our community members, whether we want that responsibility or not, it falls on us.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to set a good example within our communities. And majority of my staff, like as they started this journey, and not that it's like a negative or a positive for me, it speaks to volumes to me, is that majority of my staff is sober. and walk with cultural protocols within their life. And the other ones, even if they don't, there's that trauma-informed care that we have approach with our staff, that no matter what, their skill set is there and we're there to represent, because I've been there myself. And I just always kind of caution my staff in a good way so that whenever they leave this launch pad, this nest of like good space, that wherever they go, their career would follow them in a good light. And so we're trying to really get ready our next leaders for this queer liberation, really. And I really feel like they're just doing amazing work throughout the board, like everybody, whether it's our project coordinator, our national facilitator, our researcher, our policy analyst, our youth coordinators, our events coordinators. They're just really well-rounded. Yeah. And I just couldn't say enough about them. They're all just amazing at what they do.
Yeah. I have a question. Like, how did you use ceremony in Two Spirits in Motion Society?
There was cultural aspects within the job prior to me coming, but I prioritized it. Okay. Meaning that any project, any gathering that we had, that's the first thing that we started with. And we had like ceremony, whether it was smudging, whether it was a pipe ceremony, we had those ceremonies. And it was important to start in that kind of perspective because it then shifts the narrative of what you're trying to achieve at a meeting with other people. It sets the tone. And one of the biggest things is when I sat down with my EDC, my executive director of council, which is my kin organizations. And there was this disconnect and you can feel it. You can feel tension. Some people were not feeling heard. Some people, and like, they just needed to air their grievances. And we had this ceremony. We had a pipe ceremony and then we had like a sharing circle and it took like 3 hours. But we settled so much disharmony and we were able to reconnect in a good way. Whereas the work that we're doing, it's now intentional. Now we have like intention and purpose and we're being reminded that we're all working towards the same goal, whether there's times of like disconnect, that we can still be able to work in a collaborative way, in a respectful manner, that we can speak to each other with respect and care. And we really hold true to our values. And our values are those, like, what they call grandfather values. But we integrate the last value. We added one more, which is forgiveness. And nobody talks about that. And that's something that we always, like, hold dear to our heart. Because even if there's, like, a disconnect in community and people don't talk or there's, like, disharmony that happens, that we always remind people we still have to work with one another because we still all belong to this community. Whether you love and respect me or not, at the end of the day, we're still part of each other's community. We're still working towards the greater good of what's going to be good for our community as the 2SLGBTQQIA+. We still have to like love and respect each other enough because we're still going to be part of this community. Whether you come to our gatherings or not, we're going to run across each other and we're going to have to be able to be in those corners with one another when we're trying to do this work. Because if we start pinning each other against each other, then government places that have been in place, like Indian residential school, like any forms of cultural genocide, it's always like, try pin each other. They fight each other so we don't have to fight them. The work is being done for us.
Yeah.
I want to eliminate that in the work that I'm doing. I want to be able to sit with people and talk with them and visit with them, whether or not they have love and respect for me. But I want to be able to have their voices at the table because I believe that everybody has something to contribute within the change and the motion of what Two Spirit and Two Spirits in Motion Society is trying to develop.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that really stood out to me about your organization was that there's just so many different councils and perspectives and, like you said, voices at the table. Including a youth and elder council. So I was wondering, what have you seen emerge from these spaces?
So what happened when I first started? Of course, I had to do my very first ever audit. And, like, that was traumatic. And I laugh because it's like, as it, nobody really prepares you when you walk into not for profit, these big important things that you have to do. And one of them is to get an audit done, which is always just time consuming. It just takes a lot of time and being able to understand that process. And then we had an AGM, and out of that AGM, our youth council spoke up and they said, you don't include us. You do all of these great things, but we're not a part of it. How come? And so we passed at that AGM that we need to start doing more youth initiatives, because we talk about our youth being our future, but they weren't sitting at the table. They weren't making those big decisions. And I was like, okay, let's do it then. And then shortly after that, we got some funding money that came in, and we were able to have a youth conference. And the things that came out of that was beautiful, because we're able to use that as part of our strategy plan in order to do the work that we do. And we've had beautiful things come out of those kind of conversations. And we have our elders council. We use their wisdom. We use their knowledges of the past. We try to transfer that knowledge into the youth that we have. And what my dream is to have is that our elders council can then mentor our youth council, and they can work collaboratively together, as a, instead of just this separate of like ageism, that they can share these knowledges with one another. Because I really feel like what I feel is the disconnect is that our elders, they've gone through it all. They were able to like bring our queer liberation to where it is today. And our youth, they're just like being born and being like, I know who I am. Nobody has to tell me who I am. I know who I am. And there's less burdens in a sense that they have to go through. Not saying that they're all, I don't live in this like deluded world that everything is provided within our community or we wouldn't be here as a society. But I mean that they just come with this confidence of knowing who they are and the support that they have. Whereas our elders, when they were born, they had to really keep it quiet because it wasn't safe. And it still isn't as safe. It's still not safe. I'm not saying it's safe out there. I'm just saying that people are born with that confidence and understanding. And we have community people that are very protective and loving and caring to our two-spirited folks, our two-spirited youth. But there needs to be more. I always say that there needs to be more. We can be doing more. I feel like the more conversations I have with my Indigenous communities of saying you need to protect your youth, you really need to understand that who they are, when they say they know who they are, believe them, trust them, protect them, ask for their guidance of how to protect them, how to keep them safe, because they have the answers. It's like going to the doctors nowadays. You tell them what's wrong with you, and then they give a diagnosis of what they think is wrong with you. Whereas before, they're like, I think it's this, and that's what it is. We know ourselves best. We know what we need. And that's how we're going to be able to navigate through things. But we have crazy things that happen that is outside of us, which is like legislation, whether it's in New Brunswick or Saskatchewan or Alberta, where they're passing laws and they're calling it a parental law, and it's not. Really. They're questioning a human rights law. They're creating a law surrounding and questioning somebody's human right to self-identify. And like, it's really, of course, it's like political and conservative, and there's all these things that are occurring, but it's, we need more. And like, I don't even think it's a matter of education. I think it's a matter of ignorance. It's easier to stay. And ignorant meaning like, ignorant means not knowing. And if you know better, you do better. But some people just take on that, like, I am not going to learn anymore. I know enough and I don't feel the need to learn what you have to offer me. And it's really, it's just like, it's saddening and sickening, really, if I think about it, because it really puts in jeopardy not just our queer youth or our trans youth in jeopardy. It puts their own human rights at risk. If we start to question human rights of others, eventually we're questioning our own. And I think there's like a disconnect. Like they feel like they're just very separative about it. But the moment you start questioning somebody else's human rights, you're questioning your own and you're putting your own human rights at risk. We're no longer going to live in democracy if that continues. And I think people don't understand that, you know, especially when they're sitting in positions of power. They don't understand that when they put into question somebody else's human rights, they're putting into question their own human rights. At some point, there might be a way there. We don't have democracy anymore. You know, it might turn into dictatorship if we continue on that path. And I feel like that kind of education needs to come out there. I also feel like within our queer community, within not our queer community, our Indigenous community, I feel like they need to start understanding how important our two-spirited youth are, our trans youth are, our non-binary youth are. You know, they need to start understanding who they are and protecting them and looking after them. Because it's vitally important that the safety and well-being of our youth is put forward. And when we still question our youth or who they are, we're implementing things like Indian residential school. We're no longer in the schools. We're now governing that same idea of eliminating who we are, the uniqueness of being Indigenous, the uniqueness of being queer born. You are now taking that away and you're now implementing these white, colonial settler ideologies of who we're supposed to be. And that's not ours. So we don't need to continue that kind of dialogue. I don't know if that makes sense, but I feel like there's a lot of work that needs to be done. A lot of work.
A lot.
And it's really, really hard to do this job, but you do the best you can with every place that you are. And the places that you are, you do your best to educate people. Whenever we have any kind of conversations with our people, and I have like three or four people that come up to me and say, hey, we really need to work on this. Or you said something and really changed something within me because I don't want to be that kind of person. You know what I mean? So.
Now, what you're saying definitely does make sense completely. Yeah, with legislation and everything, I know that your organization has published the Two-Spirit Health Legislation Project. So you guys were using roundtable discussions between Two-Spirit peoples as the methodology. And yeah, there's so many issues that need to be covered, but the report, just for our listeners out there, approaches many important problems in our society, such as systemic racism within Western healthcare, which you touched on, and the lack of appropriate mental health resources in Indigenous communities. So I was wondering, how does work like this, originating from queer Indigenous peoples, benefit the Two-Spirit community on a local and national scale?
I think any work that we do on any level, we create some form of small change. We always want the bigger picture. That's always what we're going to aim for. But if we create smaller changes and we're able to have a voice at the table, our seat at the table, and some of those seats that we sit at are very, very colonized. There's a lot of settler people sitting at those tables that are making decisions about Indigenous people, for Indigenous people. But if we're sitting at that table and we're able to speak up for our community and their needs, it shows within community. Those changes show up all the time within the grassroots level because that's what they fight for on an everyday basis. This the basic needs, the basic humanity for our Indigenous and queer folks, who are both vulnerable folks because they're highly traumatized. Being Indigenous, it's highly traumatizing. Being queer is highly traumatizing. You combine that's a complex trauma that you're dealing with. And any places that we are and that we're there and we have our voices there, that's impacting decisions, whether it's on a small scale or a large. I want to get to the bigger scales. Those are difficult and more harder conversations to navigate through. But I feel like it's possible. It's
Yeah.
absolutely 100% possible. You know, when we do this work without core funding, all these other Indigenous organizations like the AFN, Métis Nation, NWAC, they get core funding. We don't. We do this on shoestring budgets, meaning I apply for six budgets, and out of their admin costs, that's what's paying for my wage to be there. Whereas everybody else is at this level playing field, at least at the bare minimum, they have those things met. And it's not that I want to take away from those communities, because I feel like those communities well represent our Indigenous communities. But we need a representation of 2S at that table. You can't tell me it's the same thing as making decisions for queer people and we're not at the table.
Yeah.
That makes no sense to me. I have to be there. I'm not saying me myself as a personal person, but I feel like there needs to be more 2S people sitting at those tables that are knowledgeable, that can carry a good message, and that can come back to places like our Executive Director Council that have 13 kin organizations collaborating together, working together, and trying to have fairness of just being at those tables that create change. I don't know if that makes sense,
No,
but
yeah, it makes sense.
essentially what we want, you know?
Yeah, that is definitely, you're right, very hard to do when there are people, other people at the table that aren't even questioning things like human rights or don't know what that experience is like with the ignorance that you're talking about too, so.
I think about it and like, how can you speak about something you've never lived?
Yeah. Exactly.
How can you care about something you've never experienced? If you've never experienced racism in your entire life, in your ideology, you think it does not exist. But when you come out of this world, especially the way I look Indigenous. Some people don't know what kind of Indigenous. They think I'm everything. They claim me. They're like, I go on vacation. They're like, you're one of us. And I'm like, probably. We're probably related somewhere. You know, but like, if you're not walking in the world where, I'll use this analogy. And it was given to me at a very young age by my grandfather. He always said, you need to get up early. You need to get there on time. You need to be there early, like 15 minutes early to half an hour early to anything that you have to go to. Okay, why? I was 17, didn't know much about life. And he said, because being Indigenous, you're starting at the bottom of the barrel. They're not going to pick you all the time. Being female identified, they're not going to pick you. You're not going to be priority. They're not going to be the thing that they want. And being Wingte, you're three steps behind already. And all you did was wake up.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're white, cisgendered male, you wake up, you have the opportunity right there. It's right there. All you got to do is extend your hand and take it. But you have all of these other steps just to catch up to that guy. So at least you could do is work hard and show up. That's the bare minimum, so that at least you're at the playing field with them. But it's going to take grit to be there, because they're going to and try intimidate you that you don't belong. You said, but you know better. You know who you are. You're Dakota, you're Cree. You know that. You know you're Wingte. You know that. You know you're female identified. You know that. You know that you're Indigenous identified. You know that. You know who you are. You know where you're going. That you have intention and purpose in this world. If you can feel your heartbeat, Chante Washte, you'd always say that. You can feel that, your heart, Chante. You need to always say, put your hand like this. You need to tell me, you know, put your right hand in like you're gonna pinch something. And you put it towards your heart and you tap on your chest and you say, you feel that? That's purpose. Anything you do with good heart, good things come out of it. So it's being able to think in that kind of mentality. That's what I've been given. I know not everybody has that. I know that being brought up in traditional ceremonial customs, protocol, and procedures, it wasn't easy. I didn't have it easy. I was ridiculed in those spaces. But having guidance like that, mentors like that, that fought for me to be there, being like, no, no, they belong sitting here. You may see a female identified. I see someone that's going to be a leader. They need to understand these roles and responsibilities at these small spaces of ceremony. They deserve to sit here. And he would shoo them away. I had strong mentors like that, that sat in places that people didn't want them. But they did that. Because they would always remind people, hey, we're not in residential school anymore. We don't follow their rules. Because here, we have natural law. And we know when we don't do things right, natural law takes over. There's customs that guide us. And the biggest thing is natural law. And one of them is being kind to our own people. Kindness is very hard to get. Respect is even harder. Got to earn it. So he would teach me these things. I come with that at the table. Not everybody has that, and I'm aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I find when I come to these spaces is that our youth are saying, we don't have culture. We don't have access to culture because there's gatekeepers there that they're saying, no, you can't come the way you are. No, you have to sit there. No, you can't come. Oh, you haven't been sober for 4 days? You need to not come. I grew up with those same protocols. But I also know that you don't go to the hospital well. You know, you come to those things sick. So give me a job that could be meaningful. I wasn't sober ever for a good chunk of my life. And my grandfather would say, go chop wood. Go chop all the wood for the sweat that they're going to have. Go chop all the wood. And you pray about it. Okay. It was a lot of grunt work. Yeah. I had to learn those things. I earned my space back. I had to earn it back. And it was those places, it was that foundation of those small understandings that gets me to that understanding of like, no, I got to help my people. I got to help all my people. You know?
Yeah.
And I can't, and it's not this euphoric way of like, I'm going to save everybody. I'm not trying to do the savior mentality. People can save themselves. They have the tools and equipment. I just got to be there to help guide them. We all need that.
That concludes the end of part one of this two-part interview with Paulette Petra. Next week at the same time on Thursday, we will continue the discussion and focus on looking 7 generations ahead and the power of traditional Indigenous art. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Pride Programming, and I'll see you next week.